This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 11th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the House of Representatives strips food assistance funding from the Farm Bill, putting millions of working poor at risk. Student groups call on Congress to act on rising interest rates, warning of a crisis of student debt. The defense rests in the Bradley Manning case, disputing the government's aiding the enemy charge and revealing more information about the Guantanamo detainee assessments. And in Wisconsin, small groups will once again be able to protest at the Capitol without a permit, but free speech advocates say restrictions are still in place. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, a Florida judge said the jury in the George Zimmerman murder case would be allowed to consider a lesser charge in their deliberations. Zimmerman had been charged with second-degree murder in the shooting death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Judge Deborah Nelson agreed to instruct the jury to also consider manslaughter a lesser offense. Yesterday, the defense rested their case without Zimmerman taking the stand to testify. The prosecution's closing statements began this afternoon. Assistant State Attorney Bernie De La Rionda argued Trayvon Martin died because Zimmerman assumed he was up to no good.
Because if the defendant hadn't assumed that, Trayvon Martin would have watched the basketball game. George Zimmerman, I'm assuming, would have gone to Target and did whatever he does on Sunday evenings, and we wouldn't be here.
Zimmerman's defense team is expected to make their closing arguments tomorrow. Not only is the U.S. government allegedly collecting citizen data through the servers of companies like Microsoft, Apple, Skype, Google, and Facebook, it is also tapping into undersea fiber cables and collecting information as data flows past. The Washington Post published what appears to be an instructional slide leaked by former NSA contractor Edward Snowden. The slide instructs the intended viewer, presumably NSA employees, to use both PRISM and upstream methods of intercepting data. A prison hunger strike in California and other West Coast states continued today, expanding to include more than 30,000 inmates. Prisoners and their advocates have released a list of five demands, enumerated in a video by the group Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity.
End long-term confinement.
End group punishment and administrative abuse.
Abolish the debriefing policy and modify gang status criteria.
Provide adequate and nutritious food.
Create and expand constructive programming.
Supporters of the striking prisoners are planning a demonstration and rally on Saturday at the Cochran Prison south of Fresno. Yesterday, state officials asked the U.S. Supreme Court to issue a stay of a lower court order requiring California to reduce its prison population by nearly 10,000 inmates. The lower court ruled overcrowding in state prison facilities prevents them from providing adequate medical and mental health care. National elections in Zimbabwe are set for the end of July, and although the country has yet to see violence and instability that plagued elections in 2008, the process has been fraught with contention. Today, a controversy involving faulty voter rolls and early voting for police triggered an official complaint from the party of the prime minister. FSRN's Gerikai Chanza has the latest from Harare.
Under Zimbabwe law, police officers scheduled to work around election day can apply to vote early. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission says nearly 70,000 officers have submitted applications to cast their ballots next week. The only problem, according to MDC party officials, is that there are only 39,000 officers in the country. Zimbabwe Finance Minister Tendai Biti is a member of the MDC. He says his party's political rival, President Robert Mugabe's ZANU-PF, wants to use the voters' roll to manipulate the election result.
There is no way that the police has got an establishment of 69,322. These figures are almost double the number of ZRP personnel that we are paying at the Ministry of Finance. So this is something that is questionable. We have no doubt in our minds that this again is a source of shenanigans.
MDC officials are also upset about the arrest of one of their youth leaders on Wednesday. They say Costa Machingauta was attacked by a ZANU-PF militia, and when he went to report the incident, police arrested and shied him instead. The incident is causing apprehension among the general public and elected officials that this is the start of political violence ahead of the July 31st election. Meanwhile, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission denied the applications of more than 50 international election monitors, according to SW Radio Africa. The US-based Carter Center says its application was turned down despite having secured support for their work from Zimbabwe's three main political parties, Garika Chaonza, FSRN, Harare.
And finally, water sampling done Wednesday by Japanese nuclear operator TEPCO shows a sudden rise in radiation levels in an underground reservoir at the Fukushima power plant. Results from the four test sites show the amount of radiation is now 2 to 5 times the detectable limit. Just a day before, the radiation levels were below that limit. On April 3rd, TEPCO discovered a leak in the underground reservoir system, and Japanese nuclear regulators say they fear the radioactive water is seeping into the ocean. These test results come as TEPCO pushes regulators to allow the world's largest capacity nuclear power plant to reopen in northwestern Japan. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Doran Marina in Los Angeles. The House of Representatives took up a revised version of the Farm Bill today that completely leaves out the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or food stamps, that millions of low-income Americans currently depend on. Republican leaders split the legislation after a bill to fund all the nation's farm and nutrition programs for the next 5 years failed to pass the House in June. They promised Thursday that the nutrition funding would be restored when the House and Senate go to conference on the bill, and said the revised bill merely strips out extraneous provisions that would prevent the bill from passing. Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern took issue with the claim.
The 47 million people who are on SNAP are not extraneous. They are important. They are part of our community, and we should not diminish their struggle.
McGovern and many fellow Democrats, as well as a number of food policy experts, say the change could result in cuts to food stamps, food banks, and other programs for low-income people, even deeper than the more than $20 billion proposed for the original bill. California Democrat Barbara Lee called it a new low for the House of Representatives.
Nobody wants this Republican bill to move forward, not the 532 companies and organizations from every congressional district who have urged this Congress to not break apart the Farm Bill, not the administration which issued a veto threat last night, and certainly not the millions of low-income and poor people and working families with children and seniors who continue to struggle from the impact of the Great Recession. Enough is enough.
If the House and Senate can't resolve their differences on the legislation, funding for farm subsidies, land and water conservation, and dozens of other programs will expire at the end of September. The U.S. Senate is considering a new proposal to address the crisis of student debt, which is expected to get worse after interest rates on federal loans doubled to 6.8% at the beginning of July. After a bill to keep the rate at 3.4% for one more year failed on Wednesday, Republican and Democratic lawmakers are introducing legislation that would lower rates for now, but allow them to increase exponentially over time. Progressive politicians and student groups are blasting the proposal. They're calling on Congress to take sweeping action to make education affordable for everyone. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Late Wednesday night, a number of senators from both sides of the aisle huddled to put together a new bill to lower the recently doubled interest rate on federal student loans. Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin told FSRN what came out of that discussion, a bill similar to one introduced by conservatives earlier this year that would tie student loan rates to the government's borrowing rates.
We are close to an agreement that will substantially reduce the interest rate from 6.8, maybe below 4%. And something happens that raises overall interest rates in the economy to some high level, we just can't let students be exposed to that kind of indebtedness. So we put caps, limits on 8.2% on the interest rate over a 10-year period of time.
Under this new plan, federal loan rates for graduate students could go up as high as 9.25% over the next decade. Durbin said the proposal would protect students, but many progressive lawmakers, including Vermont Independent Bernie Sanders, say they won't support it. Sanders told FSRN that by allowing rates to go up even higher than they have already, the bill would make college less affordable.
Remember, there are many, many countries in the world that we compete with where the cost of college education is zero, nothing, not a nickel out of the pocket of low and moderate income families. Other countries subsidize college education much more heavily than we do. I'm an hour away from Canada. College education in Canada is a lot cheaper than it is in the United States. So we've got a lot of thinking to do, but we should not make a bad situation worse.
As lawmakers argued Thursday over the rate question, some also agreed with student groups and education experts that more systemic changes are needed to address the root causes of runaway student debt. Researcher Ben Miller with the New America Foundation said Congress should better regulate the public colleges that benefit from federal dollars.
That would probably look something like what you see in other federal programs that go to education, like for K-12 or for students with disabilities, where you would place requirements on states to say, if your institutions are going to take these funds, you need to be providing a sufficient level of funding to go with it. So either that's, you know, if you're giving money to a Pell Grant student, the state needs to make sure that it's matching it or exceeding that, or that the state is giving a sufficient amount of money so that tuition won't rise as much, so that you don't see the situation you've been seeing over the last several years where hard-fought increases in Pell Grants are eaten away almost right away by decreases in state funding and increases in tuition.
National student advocacy groups are also pushing Congress to pay more attention to creative proposals being made on the state and local level. Earlier this month, the Oregon legislature unanimously passed a bill directing the state's Higher Education Coordinating Committee to study a proposal submitted by Portland State College students for making higher education entirely debt-free. The so-called Pay It Forward, Pay It Back plan would allow students to attend college without paying any tuition or fees, but they would sign a binding contract to pay the college a small percentage of their post-grad income for a certain period of years. If the commission decides the program would be successful, Oregon will consider implementing such a program in 2015. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Washington, D.C. is set to require large retailers to pay workers 50% more than the minimum wage after council members voted 8-5 Wednesday to approve a higher wage bill despite Walmart threatening to withdraw plans to build new stores in the city if it passed. The bill, which still needs to be signed by Mayor Vincent Gray, would require stores that have corporate sales of $1 billion or more and take up at least 75,000 square feet to pay workers at least $12.50 per hour. Washington, D.C.'s minimum wage is $8.25. Yesterday, the city council also passed a bill that would allow the district's estimated 25,000 undocumented residents to obtain driver's licenses identical to those carried by everyone else. Though a growing number of states offer a separate license for undocumented residents, Washington, D.C. became one of a few that wants to give the same license to all residents. FSRN's Ben King has more.
In May, D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray announced a plan to extend driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. But Gray's plan would have created a separate but equal driver's license containing a mark, effectively labeling the cardholder as undocumented. Immigrant rights advocates pushed back, insisting that a marked license would be like a scarlet letter, a concern echoed by D.C. resident Jose Alvarado.
For me, that mark is like a flag that says, like, you are illegal.
The council debated the decision over the course of two legislative sessions, but ultimately voted unanimously in favor of the bill. Their version eliminates the separate but equal mark labeling residents as undocumented, instead opting for one license for all district residents. Salvador Sarmiento of the National Day Labor Organizing Network praised the decision.
It's interesting and ironic that on one side of Washington, D.C., some of the leadership on the Hill is struggling so much, you know, with these proposals that are very anti-immigrant, xenophobic, and our leadership here in Washington, D.C., our council members, by passing one license for all D.C. residents, are really setting an example of what it means to be an inclusive community.
the bill still faces hurdles before becoming law. The mayor could veto it, and it needs approval from Congress since national lawmakers limit the authority of D.C.'s local government. For now, immigrant rights groups are counting this as a victory. Ben King, FSRN, Washington.
An estimated 300,000 people in Darfur, Sudan, have been driven from their homes in the first 6 months of this year, according to the UN. That adds to the country's crisis of more than 2 million internally displaced people. Many face dire conditions in refugee camps, including lack of adequate shelter and food, and continued violence through rapes, attacks, and even killings. For more, UN Radio's Patrick Maigua spoke to UN Humanitarian Affairs Representative Mark Cutts, who began by addressing the origins of the conflict.
Well, it's actually very complex, and it's dangerous to simplify the situation in Darfur because, yes, there are historical intertribal tensions, but there are also ongoing conflicts between rebel movements and the government. Many areas are a no-go area, and with continued conflict for many years, this has resulted in a real breakdown in law and order in many parts of Darfur. And there's a lot of criminality and tensions all over Darfur.
You said about 300,000 people have been displaced. What are their immediate needs?
There's a desperate need for food. We do have food in our warehouses, but we're very stretched now in Darfur. But these displaced people, they actually need everything. Many of them arrive in rather desperate conditions, and you find them sheltering in the desert in temperatures that go up to 45 degrees, 50 degrees during the day. They need medical supplies, they need shelter, they need clean water and sanitation. These are rather desperate conditions that many of them are living in.
And this insecurity, how is it affecting the delivery of assistance?
Well, it's very hard for us to continue humanitarian operations when you have all these new outbreaks of fighting in different areas. It makes it difficult for us to gain access to these areas. We also sometimes get caught up in this fighting. Only a few days ago, there was a fighting between government forces and militia group in Niala, which is the biggest city in Darfur. And two of our colleagues from the organization World Vision were sadly killed in that fighting. They were caught in the crossfire when a rocket-propelled grenade hit their compound. As a result of that, many of our staff have pulled out of Niala town, and they are now sheltering in a United Nations peacekeeping base just outside the city. So all of this is making it very difficult for us to operate.
That was Mark Cutts, who works for the UN Humanitarian Affairs Office in Sudan. This week, the defense for Army Private Bradley Manning rested its case at the military court-martial at Fort Meade, Maryland. Manning's legal team brought an expert to the stand that refuted the government's claim that Manning intentionally aided the enemy, one of the most serious charges he faces. More details also came out about leaked prisoner assessments at Guantanamo. For the latest, we're joined by journalist Kevin Gostola. He's been covering the trial for FireDogLake.com. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
One of the key witnesses for the defense was a professor who testified on how WikiLeaks was regarded at the time Manning leaked material to the group in 2010. What did he say?
Yochai Bankler was put on the stand. This professor from Harvard University was on the stand to be qualified as an expert who could describe how WikiLeaks is in fact a legitimate journalistic organization that fits into what Bankler has studied and researched and presented as the networked fourth estate. And what was critical about what he was describing is that Manning was charged with aiding the enemy, a serious offense that carries the possibility of being put in jail for life if he is convicted. And it's the charge is that he gave information to WikiLeaks, and by doing that, he should have known he was giving intelligence to the enemy. Also, he has a separate charge, of wantonly causing to be published on the internet intelligence that would be useful to an enemy of the United States. And this charge, Bankler's testimony was rebutting by saying that WikiLeaks is really this media organization, this 21st century kind of media organization. And so it couldn't have been wantonly, it couldn't have been reckless of Manning to provide the documents to WikiLeaks.
And Professor Benkler also specifically mentioned, as an example, the Iraq war logs. Those are the documents on U.S. conduct in Iraq. He said it as an example of what could be in the public interest. How does that fit in to his testimony?
When he was talking about these documents, he was essentially showing how there would be a valid reason why WikiLeaks would cover this material. So he was asked, I believe, by prosecutor Captain Joe Morrow about whether it would be journalism to just post secret documents, any secret documents that had no news value whatsoever. But as Benkler presented, these war logs gave a complete picture of what it was like in the war. He also went into detail on the Iraq war logs, describing how this had given a different civilian casualty account, Previously, groups had a much lower civilian casualty count in the Iraq war, but Iraq body count took the reports that Manning released to WikiLeaks and found that it was much higher than what U.S. government officials had presented.
Another witness for the defense this week was Colonel Morris Davis. He testified on the Guantanamo files. Those are the assessments of detainees held at the military prison. Although it's not certain who exactly the detainees are, there are five that seem likely to be covered here. Who are these five detainees, and why does the U.S. government seem so concerned about the info about them coming out?
These five are possibly significant in that it suggests the government has prosecuted Manning for releasing files on detainees who dared to challenge their detention by the U.S. government. One of the hints from Davis was that Shafiq Rasool was likely one of the detainees because there was a major Supreme Court decision related to habeas rights for detainees in detention, and he was part of the Tipton Three. And Davis said that the detainees profiled in the film Road to Guantanamo were the three of the files that Manning released. There's also a good possibility that one of the prisoners is a famous advocate, Mozambique, who was a British prisoner. And then the other one is there's only one detainee who remains in Guantanamo, and his name is Shakir Amer. And he's received a lot of attention during this ongoing hunger strike currently. So it seems likely that these five people are individuals who have challenged the government. And Shakir has been very active in the hunger strike in making it difficult for the government by organizing hunger strikes and resistance inside the Guantanamo Bay prison.
Kevin Gostola, the government said it could put on a rebuttal to the case. Proceedings are scheduled to resume early next week. What's next in the case?
Next week, we expect to hear oral argument on Monday about these motions for a finding of not guilty on charges of aiding the enemy, exceeding authorized access on a government computer, embezzling government property. There will also be an argument over the scope of any rebuttal from the government. And then we'll proceed to closing arguments. Closing arguments could very well happen next week. And after that, the roadmap would be the judge taking time to look over everything in the trial and to put together a ruling on whether Manning is guilty of these 22 charges.
Journalist Kevin Gostola joined us to discuss the court-martial for Bradley Manning, where the defense rested its case this week at Fort Meade, Maryland. You can follow his updates and analysis at firedoglake.com. Thanks for joining us, Kevin.
Thank you.
In Wisconsin, groups of up to 20 people will once again be allowed to peacefully assemble at the state capitol without a permit, following a decision by a federal judge this week. For over a year, groups as small as four were required to get a permit 72 hours in advance. Even a single person needs a permit for holding an event. While free speech advocates welcome the court order, many say the administration of Governor Scott Walker is still restricting their constitutional rights. For Madison, FSRN's Dylan Brogan reports.
The Solidarity Singers have been singing protest songs at the Wisconsin State Capitol every lunch hour since March of 2011, when tens of thousands occupied the Capitol grounds to protest Governor Scott Walker's controversial bill that all but eliminated union rights for public employees. Michael Kissick, an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin, says he sometimes would join the Solidarity Singers during their noontime sing-along.
For me, it was very easy to stop by the Capitol to and from work and on my lunch hour because I worked nearby. It was on my bus route, and so I would go regularly and just hold a sign. I had feelings, and I wanted to express them.
But when Capitol Police Chief David Irwin started enforcing new access rules in the fall of 2012, Kissick stopped exercising his First Amendment rights when other protesters started being arrested and given citations for demonstrating at the Capitol without a permit. This February, Kissick and the American Civil Liberties Union filed a federal lawsuit challenging the new permitting policy and were granted a partial victory this week. Kissick is very pleased that U.S. District Judge William Conley recognized that Wisconsin's state capitol has a unique and historic role as a forum for free speech and public gatherings.
What I'm saddened about is that he didn't see all of the arguments we had. So we have a number 20. If you're over 20, you have to get a permit. And so according to him, that's the number that would relate to safety issues.
Judge Conley also issued a preliminary injunction on another part of the permitting policy at the Wisconsin State Capitol that may make an unconstitutional distinction based on the content of the speech and events. Judge Conley will decide whether to make his injunction permanent early next year. Wisconsin Assemblymember Chris Taylor is celebrating the recent ruling.
What harm was it to have a group of people singing songs for an hour in the Capitol? Why was that so irritating to this governor?
If Judge Conley permanently sets the threshold for needing a permit to groups larger than 20, it could still affect the Solidarity sing-along that often attracts dozens of protest singers. Representative Taylor said it would also prevent the massive street protests and occupation of the Capitol seen in the snowy streets of Madison shortly after Governor Walker took office in 2011.
If this governor gets reelected, we are going to see a right-to-work bill. And part of what they never want to happen again is to see 150,000 people at the Capitol protesting. They don't want to see 10 people at the Capitol protesting.
U.S. District Judge Conley also issued a stay this week on another law strongly backed by Governor Walker. On Monday, he issued a 10-day freeze on a requirement that doctors who perform abortions have hospital admitting privileges. Critics of the restriction say that it would cut the number of abortion clinics in Wisconsin from four down to two. Judge Conley will decide next Thursday whether to issue a temporary injunction to the new requirement on abortion providers, pending a final ruling. Dylan Brogan, FSRN, Madison.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can check out more sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marino.